Coming up on Let's Clear the Air.
Net zero poverty is just as important as net zero emissions, but I don't think we get to net zero emissions unless we begin to transition those in poverty. They simply can't afford to do the kinds of things that need to be done for the climate.
Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast, conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future. Your hosts are energy and climate expert Dr. Andrew Parker and midstream industry veteran Adam Murray. Now, here are Andrew and Adam.
Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Podcast. I'm Andrew Parker, along here with Adam Murray, and we're really excited about today's episode. We have one of the great thinkers when it comes to talking about the global energy transition in Dr. Scott Tinker. Dr. Tinker is the director of the Bureau of Economic Geology and the State Geologist of Texas and a professor at the Jackson School of Geosciences at the University of Texas, Austin. He's an international speaker on this topic. He has TV shows. Adam, what else am I missing with Dr. Tinker? His resume, his bio is just, it's so impressive.
Oh yeah, we're gonna talk to Dr. Tinker about his work as the founder and chairman of the Switch Energy Alliance, whose goal is to inspire an energy-educated future. He hosts a PBS talk show, Energy Switch, where he brings together experts with differing perspectives to discuss the most pressing energy and climate issues. And so with that, Dr. Tinker, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. We like to start off all of our episodes with a little bit of an icebreaker question. And we were checking out your semi-recent TED talk that you gave, and you gave a great food analogy with kale and ice cream. So to start things off, let's clear the air about it. Are you still eating kale over ice cream, or what's your food of choice these days?
you missed the part in between, the cow.
there you go. Yeah.
So, you know, you hit me on a good day. I actually had my annual physical today, so I had to fast all night and through the morning. And yes, it was great to have something to eat again. I love kale. People, like my friends, have all given me crap about that, but I actually love kale. I think I do eat it, but I like cow too, so I eat both. And yeah. And then less and less ice cream. That seems to be the one that is paying fewer dividends as I push further into my 60s.
Like you said in the TED talk, balance, right?
Right.
Balance.
It's the balance.
Yep. So Scott, maybe to set the stage for the conversation, I noticed our last guest was Robert Bryce, and I noticed you did a panel with him last week at EarthX, and Robert posted a video saying that you gave a great overview of energy security, the environment, and the economy, and I'm curious if you'd be willing to give kind of a similar overview to kind of kick off this discussion.
Robert never shares those compliments with me. I have to get him to be more forthcoming there. we had fun. I think that was the first time EarthX had tried an energy conference. So yeah, I kicked it off, and then Robert and Cindy Yielding were on a panel that I kind of moderated. We had fun. It was good. Now look, these three things, energy security and economic security and environmental security or climate security, if you want to be more specific, they definitely play together in the world. And it's tough to push too far in one direction without leaving the others behind. And finding that balance is really critical. You know, energy underpins healthy economies, and healthy economies allow you to invest in the environment, both reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but the land, the air, and the water. So you really have to think about how those play, and typically energy is required for a healthy economy. All the major economies in the world have reasonably secure energy. And healthy economies are needed to invest in the environment. I've been in 60 countries, I've been very fortunate in my life. The worst environments in the world are where it's poor. You know, the most polluted water, the most polluted soil, the air quality that's terrible, and they just can't afford it. They can't afford to clean it up. They don't have different priorities. So this little dance, this little waltz, I've been talking about forever in various ways, but it's vital. It's vital to understand. And again, if you want 100% zero emissions, you're gonna, the other two could struggle. And the same, if you push all into, all about the economy, you could see the environment suffer and that kind of thing. So it's an interesting balance.
So maybe in the context of the ongoing conversation around energy and the environment, put that in the context of what we're being asked to do with renewables and the practicality and implications for some of those poor countries.
I think it's important to think of the world as a globe, because there's only one atmosphere. So what you just described is got some passion behind it in the US and Western Europe, which represents less than 7% of the global population. And then there's the other 93% of the global population in emerging and developing economies, from those that are living in severe poverty, essentially nothing, all the way up through emerging and developing. And that includes 6 to 7 billion people. So this is a context that I think in, and we have to set the goal of emissions reductions and the rate of those in that context. Right now, to lift most of the world up out of poverty, which I think is my passion, if you will, is going to take a tremendous amount of energy. Mm-hmm. Lots of energy. Per capita, they don't have much. In the aggregate, they don't have much. And the way they're getting it is like the same way we got it. They're leaving hay behind and hopefully and cooking with wood and dung indoors and other kinds of things, which we featured in our film Switch On a few years ago. We were really one of the first to bring energy poverty to light. They're starting to transition from that into denser forms of energy, and it's mostly coal in a lot of the places that have it. Hydro, where they have it, other forms. And then distributed solar and wind in places that have nothing. I've put solar in mud hut villages in Colombia. I mean, we installed it for. So, you have to think about the world in different stages of transition. And that's what's hard to conceptualize. Yes, the rich world, us and Europe, are. We have all the energy we need, really, in many ways, and we've been lowering our per capita in some ways as we continue to grow the economy. But that's not most of the world. Most of the world needs energy. They need something to get started that's affordable, or they need something to make theirs more secure. That's the dominant part of the world. That's the context in which we have to think about these things. So net zero poverty is just as important as net zero emissions. They both have to happen. But I don't think we get to net zero emissions unless we begin to transition those in poverty. They simply can't afford to do the kinds of things that need to be done for the climate. And candidly, they're not focused on them. They're focused on secure energy. They're focused on energy to get started, to cook and have some shelter and move themselves around and begin to get some education and some healthcare and the other kinds of things that energy provides modern societies. So it really has to go in that way. I would love to see young people particularly get passionate about poverty. I would love to imagine if Greta Thunberg were to lead a global movement to lift the world from poverty. Imagine mobilizing the talent that exists in Europe and the US, the rich world, the young talent, to think about and do that. It's solvable, it's actually accomplishable. We could see the results on a year-on-year basis. It's a positive thing to work on, as opposed to just protesting, a lot of the things that are going on today. And I understand that concern, but what a positive movement. And it doesn't even have to be either or, but I'd love to see that begin to happen. And I'm very much engaged in that. So I hope that helps. It's a long It's a long description, but really, truly, we can't really address global atmospheric emissions until we begin to lift the world up into the kind of economic circumstances that the rest of us enjoy.
Yeah. That brings up so many questions. You know, first off, touching on your documentaries, right? You've hosted a couple of incredible documentaries, Switch and then Switch On, and then the PBS show, which we'll get into here in a little bit. But, you know, when you were starting out with those, you know, what did you really set out to accomplish? Was it this tackling of poverty, or was there a different, you know, a different goal in mind when you were doing those?
Yeah, no, not with the poverty in mind. We set off in 2009 to film Switch.
Yeah,
took a couple of years. That, you remember, that was the start of the Great Recession. So we, Harry Lynch, he's the filmmaker. I'm just a pretty face, but he's the brains behind all this. He and I have been working together for 15 years now. We set off to make the film and just look at global energy, where it's best in the world. So we went to 11 countries and filmed the best sites for each form of energy and also some of the challenges.
Yeah.
So we looked at the pros and cons, and in many ways, this was a film about energy transition, released in 2012, you know, after post-production. And it got very popular. It was used because it was kind of an adventure and almost a travel guide. And you got to see all these different kinds of energy and what the environmental impacts of all of them. They all have them. And the benefits, people use it in college classes and high schools. And it got very popular around the world. Harry went off and made a beautiful series on mental health called Stories of the Mind. And then we got back together. I remember talking with him saying, Harry, we kind of left out half of the world, it turns out. I continue to speak about energy. I said, there's just so many people in the world that don't have the kinds of things that we have. Mm-hmm. So that's when we got back together and started filming Switch On in very different countries. The first one was nuclear in France and solar in Spain and wind in Denmark and geothermal in Iceland, et cetera, et cetera. We went to Kenya and Ethiopia and Vietnam and Nepal and Colombia for Switch On, where people don't have much energy or different levels of energy. So that's when we started to put the world together through the total energy picture and got pretty passionate about the tight relationship between energy poverty and economic poverty. Very close. And they all have to play together. So this is how that happened. And we continue to evolve our thinking, particularly with this PBS series, this talk show we're doing now on energy and climate. And we can talk about that later if you want to. But it really is bringing all of these together now.
Well, I got two follow-up questions. So first off, did Zac Efron contact you when he did Down to Earth on Netflix? Because it's very similar. I watched it and I immediately thought of Switch because it's very similar. But sort of joking aside there. But let's dig into the PBS show, Energy Switch. So, yeah. You know, the goal is bringing diverging views together, to talk about solutions. We're kind of trying to do that here as well as we continue to get guests on our show. And energy and climate have become such emotional issues. Robert Bryce talked about how it's almost a religion these days and gave a really good, you know, talk about that. But, you know, is there common ground? Are you finding common grounds in your experiences? And if so, you know, what are some lessons that you've learned on that?
Yeah, it's interesting. And back to the filmmaking is funny. There've been a lot of films that have come out sort of similar theme to ours since, and that's terrific. Everybody has different perspectives and brings different things to the table. So the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned. Common ground exists for sure. It happens when you look for it. If you have two, in our show, Energy Switch, we have two guests on every episode. And they're really high-level people. So they're not unimpeachable, but they're pretty high-level folks. Got some good track record, and they come from NGOs, they come from academia, they come from government and industry, all walks of life. And we talk about a specific topic, And we'll talk for an hour and a half, and then we edit that down to 25 minutes. And they don't agree on everything. They agree on some things. But it's a civil dialogue. That's the point. And we talk about data. The best episodes for me were when I don't have to say much. They're having a dialogue, and I can just kind of lightly moderate and keep it on track. Occasionally, I have to insert myself and say, "Hey, what's the data for that? You know, where's that come from? I haven't heard that before that way." But mostly, we get these dialogues going, and you realize that there's nothing binary. There's nothing black and white or clean and dirty, or even religious terms like believer or denier. Where did this come from and why? These are complex topics. When you start thinking about the world's economy and the energy and the environment, those are huge things and they affect so much. So nothing in there is simple, but it is solvable if you deal with some of the complexity. And so what we do is look for common ground, places that people do agree, and it's a lot usually, and then points of difference to make sure it's not just language or communication issues, but real points of difference based on information and data and facts and knowledge and other kinds of things. So that becomes very powerful. And I think our audience there, PBS, is educated, a little bit left to center, more than, you know, the demographics. But they write us and say, "Wow, I just had no idea. If I had a dollar for every time I heard I had no idea, then right. Be great. We would fund the whole program." But people don't know these things, and they think they do. That's the challenge, because it's been so oversimplified and then politicized. And yes, it is passionate. Passion can become whatever word you want to use for passion. We're all emotive creatures. Humans are just emotional creatures. And our passions run, but so you know, I always laugh, don't bring data to a passion fight. You'll probably lose. Because it's not about data at that point. The goal is to get it back into the world of recognizing all of our biases and all of our beliefs and where we come from, and then seeing if we can find some common ground there in which we can work together. And that's the thing, Adam, is to try to find points of convergence. I call it the radical middle. I've written about that and talked about it for 15 years. The radical middle, radically lonely, but it's getting less lonely. Shows like yours and others are really trying to find this place that we can work together in the economics and the energy systems and the environmental impacts, and compromise and be wrong on occasion and grow and learn. As that happens, we succeed. And I speak to policymakers, regulators, I speak to educators and industry leaders all the time, and students and NGOs, and it's working. It's happening. We're seeing people thoughtful. Now look, picture a bell curve, you know, right? And we've got our one sigma about the middle two thirds around that mean, median, and mode, and about two thirds. Well, that's the audience we're working with, really. And as you start to get the two sigma and three sigma out into those tails, you're never going to really cause people to change there. People are pretty dug in. And boy, that's on both sides. If it's a political spectrum, it's on both sides, and et cetera, et cetera. And that's okay. I'm not trying to, and they might not even be wrong, but I'm not trying to bring three sigma into the radical middle. But there's plenty of work to do right in there around that. My doctor this morning, I had my physical, and he's very smart. We've known each other a long time. And he says, "I lean a little left and you seem to be a little more center." And, you know, he goes, "But man, we have the greatest conversations and I love watching your stuff." And that's the whole point. Yeah. And he doesn't really know where I am politically, because I don't even know. So I don't really care, but that's the dialogues we have to have. And that's what we're trying our best to do.
So Scott, as a follow-up, what has been the hardest demographic to have those conversations with? Is it the Gen Z, millennials, boomers? Who is the most interested in having that, "Hey, leave your bias at home and let's just have a conversation"? And who are the ones that are the hardest to have that conversation with in your experience, and why?
Yeah. It's a really wonderful thought experiment. I gave a TED talk about a year ago, 1,100 students in the room, and you know, it was a tough talk to give. I had to say at one point, you're not going to like me, but there's no such thing as renewable energy. And I had kind of built into that, explaining that everything is mined and manufactured and wears out. And we dump it into the earth, the atmosphere, and do it again. And so as a geologist, I don't mind mining, but that's not a renewable. None of that is renewable processes. And so you can see the faces in the audience. I look at my audiences. I don't use notes or anything. Mm-hmm. And lines of kids, students afterwards, wanting to talk about that very thing. Haven't heard this before. Why is that? And some were frustrated they hadn't heard it. You know, yeah. A few probably were frustrated and went away, but most stuck around just to begin that dialogue. So I don't look at this as a generational thing as much. I think there's no group necessarily that's hardest to have it with. It's personalities almost about how deeply entrenched any of us get in our biases and being able to let those go. You know, those who have been around for a long time like me sometimes struggle to let our biases go. And I have plenty. Maybe younger people are more open to it. On the other hand, you know, I've gotten with plenty of younger people too that have pretty strong passion around things and don't want to really necessarily engage in the data dialogue, but not many. And I go to universities and lecture several a year, and I pick the tough ones about energy, by the way, energy and climate. I don't go to OU and mines and A&M. I go to, you know, UPitt and Wesleyan and some of the coastal schools, and where they're really committed and they've made up their minds, and we have these dialogues. And again, it truly is fun to engage with them. I learn things, but I think they do too, and come away with a little bit different set of perspectives. Probably the hardest to engage to directly answer, Andrew, is, and again, I haven't heard these questions, so I'm kind of thinking on my feet, but is those who have the most serious conflicts, and usually conflicts of interest or conflicts of commitment or conflicts of conscience. And those are the three big areas of conflict. Conflicts of conscience, like a conscientious objector. I object to a war. I believe solar and wind don't emit. Therefore, that's what I'm going to do. And as they realize the things that needs to make the solar panels and wind turbines and batteries and the mining and everything, there's an evolution. Or I might have a conflict of interest where I'm financially conflicted. And boy, that happens across the board. That's not just oil and gas people. There's a lot of people pushed into solar and wind these days, or nuclear. There's a lot of people pushed into government investments, I'll call them kindly, in all of this space. Mm-hmm. You know, they figured out how to make a bunch of money off of taxpayers, which is who pays for all the government investments. And they don't really want to change. So whenever you start getting the most severe conflicts, I often find, or resistance, I find there's money involved somewhere. Yeah,
that makes sense. I thought that TED talk you did last May, and if listeners want to hunt down that, it's on YouTube. It's called The Dual Challenge of Energy and the Environment. It's about 17 minutes. It was a really great talk. You use that analogy of the diet, right? Kale, cow, ice cream, and the different densities therein of the foods to, I think, take a concept that is somewhat abstract and make it easier to consume for the listeners. And they always think that's something really important is that relatability piece when we talk about these topics. That's to say, not to ask a redundant question, but, you know, really curious what the level of discourse is that you have at the academic level at UT. And the reason I ask that is because, at least in my experience, I find that that's where we tend to see some of the more polarized viewpoints. And, you know, I have colleagues here. I'm in Denver, Colorado, and have colleagues at, you know, universities throughout the state who have told me some of their experiences being in an academic setting, but working on energy, pro oil and gas energy topics, and being protested, being, you know, being kind of, I don't want to say persecuted, because I think that's a bit of a harsh word, right? But just harassed. Harassed is a better word. And so I'm just curious, you know, what life is like and the interactions that you have at the academic level when you have these conversations.
Yeah. Oh, it's all fair. I think when my first film came out, I went to about 20 universities with it. I picked, again, the tough ones, Stanford and Berkeley and University of Colorado, University of Michigan, et cetera. Even back then in 12, there's been a fairly strong educational push in the West, again, in the US and Western Europe. Let me keep that focus there, that oil and gas is transitioning away and we need to, the sooner the better. That's a pretty strong academic push, although not everywhere. Now, the rest of the world, nope. I've been to all the countries and lectured in most of the universities, and oil and gas is alive and well, thank you. And they're happy to have it transition away here. That just means Aramco and PetroChina and, you know, Petronas and Petrobras and other big national oil companies will be developing it, and they'll get their students jobs. So we shouldn't confuse this United States and Western Europe push with a global push on oil and gas. It's not. Now, when you start to introduce that kind of dialogue, what you're really doing is beginning to limit options. Okay. And I put out a piece in Fortune last fall about optionality. Anytime you legislate away options, for example, no natural gas hookups, some cities and states are starting to do that. Colorado's got a couple smaller towns that have tried that. And then just last week, the courts came out and said, no, there's a law from 1975 federal that doesn't let you do that. So this is almost, you know, almost 50 years ago, the federal legislature. So we'll see where that goes. Mandating EVs and no combustion engines or even CNG or fuel cells. When you start eliminating options like that, markets respond very poorly, and they always have. Markets like options, and that means people like options. So this is one of the great challenges, I think, that Europe is facing as they look at their cost of electricity just way up relative to most places, and the cost of gasoline and energy in general, and they're losing companies and industries, and the poorest among them are paying the most proportionally. That's called regressive in economic terms. So it's a regressive set of policies where I'm paying, I can't afford the electricity at that cost, and I can't afford gasoline at that cost. So this is vital. I think in our institutions of higher learning here, and again, I travel every week somewhere. I've given 7 talks in the last 2 weeks in 5 states. So, and before that was a couple countries in Europe. So I'm not engaged at the level of granularity at UT like that, although I know most of the folks. But when you start to really think about it, the best thing we can do with our students is continue to give them the critical thinking skills, how to think, not what to think. And I think we cross this line on occasion. Here's what you need to think. And if you don't think this, somehow you're a denier. Okay, that's destructive on many different levels. Now, we can't go off talking about things that violate physics, you know, or first principles of economics and other things. But we got to quickly come in and say, well, you know, how does that work? How does that work with the second law? Or how does that work with basic economics? But we need to be able to have these broader dialogues around these things, because we aren't that smart. There's a whole lot going on, and we always got to bring in the global context to that.
Scott, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
This podcast is brought to you by Let's Clear the Air, a public education campaign of GPA Midstream Association and GPSA Midstream Suppliers. The midstream industry helps power the lives of 330 million Americans by working around the clock to provide reliable energy, counteract climate change, and strengthen our country's economy. Let's Clear the Air is about promoting a constructive dialogue on the future of energy. Learn more and join the conversation at letscleartheairnow.org. Now, back to Andrew and Adam.
For background for folks, I met Dr. Tinker, Scott, about 10 years ago at the local level, Gas Processors Association, Denver chapter. We had you come up to our annual meeting, and I was, you know, blown away by that presentation at that time. I believe the theme of that one was, it's not really business as usual, right? You know, to make these big changes. And, you know, so I've personally since been involved with the Switch Energy Alliance. The educational challenge that you host, you want to share kind of a little bit about the Switch Energy Alliance and all the things you guys do, up to and including the PowerPoint that you have posted, where you're challenging people to speak. I'm going to take up that challenge here pretty soon, I hope so.
I love it. I hope you do. I hope everybody does. Sure. We had our first film Switch. And then later when we got back to do energy poverty, I formed a 501c3 called the Switch Energy Alliance. And it's all about education, mostly film based. So we filmed our energy poverty film. We made a series on energy poverty, something called the Switch Energy Lab, which is me in a goofy white lab coat and glasses doing 29 experiments with energy. That got really popular in middle schools and high schools. Mm-hmm. So we built something called Switch Classroom around that, wrote the platform, and then worked with a teacher advisory council of high school teachers across the nation, still are more than 10 teachers for the curriculum, and put that out for AP Environmental Science class in high schools. And it launched it in COVID. We got 6,000 or 7,000 teachers and 50,000 students, and it just keeps growing, using that now and getting, again, raising their AP scores, but also seeing all the sides of this issue. We've got a case competition for university campuses and college campuses, international, on energy poverty, teams of four, that take one of three countries and try to lift them out of poverty for real. You know, not fairy dust, but what resources they have, what's their government system, what economic system, what educational levels, how are we really going to do this? And then we have volunteer mentors that work with each team and judging cash prizes. And the top teams, we bring on two interns every year at Switch Energy Alliance. This year, it's two female Indian students who are going to be with us for a year as interns. We built a museum film for IMAX features and big energy halls. It's playing in Perot and Houston Museum and Midland, and I'm just getting going. And then the PBS series, that's for the public. We've already talked about that, you know, we released season two a couple of weeks ago. I've already filmed season three. Season four will be filmed in August. We don't do it live. We take it into post-production and just bring you the essence of things. Sure. So the Switch Energy Alliance is really about nonpartisan energy education. And everybody says that, but it's hard to be nonpartisan. I know we are, because hardly anybody there agrees with me politically. So we have all these great dialogues and debates and discussions, and as we converge on what's really the essence of the message and trying to extract the politics around that. And we will continue to do that. We're working on some other neat verticals as well. So, you know, the TED Talk kind of comes out of that. And then I posted a deck. I make PowerPoints, really animated ones, and they're very powerful. They have a lot of data, but they move and they kind of build as you go and scale things. So you can really begin to understand this. And I put that up a couple of weeks ago on our website and have been challenging people to take it. And I don't know how many slides are in there, a bunch, and grab a few that you like and go talk to 20 people, Adam. You know, go talk to a classroom, go talk to a scout troop or a civic group or a church group, whatever it is, to 20 people. Give a talk and talk about these things and see how it goes for you. People love live discussions. And so we've already had that deck downloaded close to 400 times in a couple of weeks. So If everybody does 20, that's 8,000 people reached live. And it's time. It's time to start really having these dialogues for real. And I can't do it all. So I'm glad you're going to help.
Well, Andrew, it doesn't sound like you're busy at all. So, I mean, build in some more time in your day. That's a long list, right? First, I have been lucky enough to be a judge for the case competition. Had multiple groups from Egypt, India, Nigeria, all solving real world problems, very intricate presentations, very detailed. So I challenge everyone to go out there and take a look at the Switch Energy Alliance website and just check out more of everything that's going on. It's a lot of great content.
Thank you for doing that. And we just formed a faculty advisory council for it. So Andrew, maybe we've got faculty now who are going to help us craft this and get more U.S. and Western Europe college campuses engaging in this, because it's really everybody needs to hear about it, not just people living in energy poverty, but everybody needs to hear, or we won't solve it. So anybody on your listening audience who want to be a mentor, we welcome it. It's easy to sign up on the website. And you have a lot of fun. It's very, very humbling.
Yeah. And I know, you know, for me, I kind of asked that question too out of that. I came out of my undergrad very negative towards oil and gas, like very negative. And it wasn't until I did an internship with Shell that kind of opened my eyes to the fact that these are a lot, you know, especially the big guys, right? The tier ones and tier twos are not just these greedy oil and gas companies that I had in my mind, but they're integrated energy companies that are forward thinking in many of the aspects that we're talking about. So I think that spreading that message across college campuses, because, you know, listening to you talk is just so refreshing. And that term you coined, radical middle, I love, right? Because that's, I think, the goal that Adam and I have for having these conversations is like not left, not right, but like just fact-based, right down the middle, draw your own conclusion type conversations. And so it's been, I think, awesome listening to your perspective on how to have these conversations with others. I think we've got a couple more questions for you. And the last question that I wanted to ask was, you know, this podcast is part of a campaign that the GPA Midstream organization is putting together to, again, try to, you know, better address and communicate the role of the midstream sector in particular and the contributions that we make to a better energy future. And I'm just, you know, curious, you know, for the midstream professionals who are listening to this, you know, what's your advice, or what are some, you know, opportunities or low-hanging fruit that you see for the midstream organization when it comes to having these conversations and the role going forward?
Sure. Well, I actually didn't know the context of this, so I'm glad you clarified it for me. I've spoken to GPA Midstream, but I speak to fuels and lubes and marketers and power companies and everybody. You know, we are not oil and gas only. We're energy and in the environment. I would say for your folks, and I talk a lot about this, we're not going to electrify everything. Okay, that's a neat phrase, but most of the things in the world actually are molecules. We have to have molecules for everything, and particularly even to make other things. So to make cement and to make steel, we have to have a lot of heat. Pretty hard to do with just electricity. To make plastics and ammonia, you have to have molecules that go into those. So moving molecules from source to use is a big deal, whether it's pipelines, trucks, barges, whatever, safely. As we move into taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, we're going to move supercritical CO2 from some source to some sink. That's a pipeline. There's storage for that. There's compression for that, and then injecting it and monitoring it. Hydrogen itself, you got to make it somewhere or somehow. There's some free hydrogen, but not much, natural or whatever you want to call it. So you make it, either split the methane molecule or the water molecule, which is harder. and you move it. It's hard to keep track of. So special pipelines, and how do you store it? That's a midstream challenge. Is it in salt domes only, or are there other kinds of systems we can store it and get it later? It will burn. How do you do that safely? Even geothermal energy. If you start thinking about geothermal, yeah, maybe you can get heat, enough heat contrast from deep wells or something like Iceland near to the surface, that geothermal gradient. But you've got to be able to move heat and use and store heat and move things that come from the heat. So everything really is midstream. If something's generated and something's used and everything else, there's something happening. We're moving energy in some form around to either use it later or in products or whatever. So it's a remarkable, and including electrons, I got to move electrons. We very rarely use them where they're generated. You got to move them. So everything in energy really has a big midstream to it. I would just encourage your members to be proud of what they do. Don't be embarrassed by it. Be proud of it. People ask you what you do. Oh, look, maybe you're in the oil and gas side of that. I'm in the oil and gas business. I'm a pipeline business. We're working to lift the world out of poverty. What do you do? just be proud of that. And it'll open up a whole different set of dialogues. And then keep doing it really well, I would say, Andrew. Let's not have leaks. We don't need to be leaking methane.
Yeah.
And if you know it's happening, even if you haven't been, kind of told to stop it anyway. Let's get out after that. You can see it from space. EDF is flying a satellite around with sensors now. So flaring, enough flaring. I know the reasons and the challenges, but let's do it much better. Mm-hmm. so that people understand there's a lot of integrity to those processes. It happens at scale. There's lots of eyes on these things because those are at scale. There's eyes starting to happen with solar and wind and batteries. I got to mine and make those things and put them in cars and then dump them into landfills. We're dumping turbine blades into landfills. We're dumping solar panels into landfills. The eyes are starting to happen. That's my TED talk. Everything has impact. So it's all midstream things if you really think about it. And there's a huge, huge world out there. If anybody's worried about not having a job, you're going to have to live a long time.
No, that's a great answer for being put on the spot. So
yeah, you bet.
Is there anything that we haven't yet discussed or something that you have coming up that you might want any of our listeners to know about or look into?
I'd love to have people take those PBS that we stream on our website episodes and do lunch and learns with them. They're 25 minutes. You can watch it away and then do a 15-minute lunch and learn. We've actually put up for season one a guide for the host to use. Here's some questions we could talk about, et cetera. Because what's happening is I think you're seeing particularly younger people maybe worry about the industry they're in, getting pressure from friends and colleagues and wondering if they're doing a good thing or not. And these kinds of dialogues really help people realize, well, here's the actual what's happening, and it is a good thing. So I'd love to see more engagement around those. They're set up perfectly for that. And then again, just recognizing the critical importance of this energy industry that we're in, whatever sector of it you're in, is vital, and that your career will evolve through time. Your career will take lots of turns. So say yes to a lot of things and hang on for the ride, because it's such a great ride. Being in this industry that brought in is such a great ride. You don't know today. If you're 30, you have no idea what you're going to be doing when you're 60. Okay. I promise. There's just so much that changes. So hang on to it. Say yes to a lot of things and really enjoy it as you go. It's remarkably powerful industry to be in, and it has probably the greatest global effect, the greatest global effect on the human condition or the human flourishing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that leads us to our final question. So let's just say it's, 3 years from now, and you're back on our show. Hopefully we have you sooner than that. But 3 years from now, you're back on our show and you're happy. You're in a good mood. What's happened in the energy world to make you happy?
That's a great question. When I'm interviewing people, I often ask it in reverse. if you're here 3 years from now and you hate this job, what would have caused that? And they look at me like, I haven't thought about that. Oh, you know, dialogues. I think in 3 years, if we're having global dialogues that are engaging and civil and complete. So I testified at the U.S. Senate a couple of years ago now to Manchin's first hearing on climate. And I said, there's a difference between completely factual and factually complete. And factually complete is hard. It requires you to look at all the different aspects. So the more conversations that we have that are incorporating different aspects of the economy and energy and the environment, the more factually complete dialogues, I'll be happy. Because then I know we're really going to be addressing these issues for the long term. And not judging. The other thing that would make me thrilled is if we can just get rid of this shaming that's going on. Cancel shaming, enough. You know, there are probably bad actors out there. I'm sure there are, but most people are not bad actors. So if somebody comes online and says something, don't just jump on them and cancel them or whatever the words are now. Listen, they might have something to share. Engage. Let's have dialogues. Enough shaming. Critical thinking is vital. So in 3 years, I'll be really happy if we can have been a part of that to encourage those conversations to continue.
Amen to that. Amen to that. I think Adam and I would both agree. So, hey, Scott, it's been about 40, 50 minutes. We cannot say thank you enough for the hour that you've given us. We know you're super busy and really appreciate your perspectives and sharing your message with the GPA Midstream community here on the Let's Clear the Air podcast. And we hope to have you back soon. Thanks so much.
You bet. Yeah, it's been my privilege. Thanks for what you guys do. Keep it up.
And that'll do it for this episode. Andrew, what's your takeaways?
Scott is the king of one-liners. I was taking notes furiously during that discussion, but a couple of the things that he said that just stuck out to me, probably the number one thing he said is net zero poverty is just as critical as net zero emissions. I just thought that was a really powerful line of his, and just some other things. Don't bring data to a passion fight, right? I thought that was really, a good way to kind of characterize some of the conversations we have about climate and energy. The radical middle, right? I really like that too, because I think that's what you and I would probably identify with, is just these people who are just trying to have these middle of the ground, fact-based conversations. And so many good little one-liners out of him. It was a really enlightening and refreshing conversation with him. What was some of your takeaways, Adam?
You know, I've been, as mentioned, been a part of a lot of what the Switch Energy Alliance does. And I just want to reiterate the challenge that Dr. Tinker laid out there to, you know, download the PowerPoint, check out the PBS show worksheets, present to folks, have the energy discussion like we're trying to do. I just think that if we can bring him back in 3 years and be having those discussions still and be happy, then that would be a good thing. As always, we love to hear from our guests. Any suggestions, questions, comments, you can connect with Andrew and I on LinkedIn and get those over to us. We look forward to hearing those. And thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next time on Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast with Adam Murray and Dr. Andrew Parker. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.